Honor and privilege to introduce to you Larsine G. from Hawthorne, California.
Hi, everybody. My name is Larsine. I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. It's a real honor and a privilege to be here, and I want to thank Liz and Carolyn for asking me to come, and I want to thank Chuck for being such a good host and picking us up at the airport, even though Ajit tried to talk us into going with somebody else down to Houston. And of course, my husband was willing to go. And it's just been a wonderful conference. We've really enjoyed ourselves tremendously, and the speakers have all been absolutely fabulously wonderful. I don't really feel much pressure up here because you've already gotten your registration's money worth, you know. So I could bomb out, and you're still going to be bucks up on this conference. I mean, they've all just been absolutely tremendous, you know. But I think that I've been touched the most by the Alateens. They have just done a beautiful job, and. You know, and how important it is to remember, you know, it's not just Al-Anon, you know, it's Al-Anon and Alateen. You know, we are together on this deal. And it was just a wonderful thing to come here and watch, the, you know, these two fellowships so well together, to see the Alateens, you know, talk up here with the Al-Anons. And, you know, because I talk at a lot of these things, but they're usually AA conferences, you know, and it's Alcoholics Anonymous with Al-Anon participation, you know, and that just always grates my cheese, something fierce. I can't even tell you. You know, because I'm used to talking during the golf tournament and, you know, all that kind of crap. And, you know, and I just love the, it's the truth. And, anyway, so I know in the Alateens sometimes, you know, they get stuck in those places, you know, when it's just not convenient for us to go. And, you know, and it's so important. It's just so important for us to be there, you know. And you know, an Al-Anon participation. I always think about that when I'm at an AA conference. Boy, they sure as hell didn't mind Al-Anon participation when they were in jail, did they? Yeah. Yeah, who are they calling? I'll tell you who they're calling. Now we want Al-Anon participation, don't we? Yeah. But anyway, it's a real honor and a privilege to be here. You know, the really short story, I think Mary Fran probably gave the best Al-Anon talk I ever heard. The bottom line is, you know, I came to Al-Anon and it helped me. You know, and if you know, you can go home now, because that's really, you know, that's just, you know, that's it in a nutshell. You know, that's the 30-second version, you know, and from all the speakers that we've heard, you know, this weekend, AA, Al-Anon, Alateen, you know, that's the same thing. You know, I come here and it helps me. I think it's been just everybody that has spoken, you know, has just really talked about, you know, what the program has done for them, and it's helped them. You know, life still goes on. Things aren't always the way we want them to be, and people die, and people get sick, and, you know, life just goes on. But no matter what's going on, I come to Al-Anon and it helps me. It helps me go through whatever processes that I have to go through at the time. And I'm truly grateful. I stand before you this morning, you know, as grateful as I know how to be. You know, because for me, what Al-Anon done is it's made my heart bigger. It's just made my heart bigger, and I'm just so grateful for that. Because when I came here, I was pretty flat-chested, let me tell you. I mean, there was just, you know, and I'm nothing bad. It's pretty good from nothing, you know, and... And I know it's not because my boobs are any bigger, you know. I know it's because my heart has gotten bigger here, you know. It's because, and it's the love that you guys give me that fills my heart, that makes my chest stand out. And I love it. And the sense of humor and the ability to laugh at things and have a good time with stuff. You know, I was always pretty self-conscious because I've always been a little bit small on top. And then one day was my vision started getting bad. My husband got me one of those magnifying mirrors for putting on my makeup. And it's like a 10-time magnifying, you know. And one time it accidentally tilted down. And it was like, whoa, you know. Oh, come here, honey, look. You know. And life is good, you know, and life is good, you know, and it's like Brad said, it's just attitude, you know, it's just, it's your attitude, it's what I choose my day to be, and today, you know, because of people like you and the message that you gave me, you know, and the love you share with me, you know, I choose to have a good life today, and I think that that's out there for everybody. You know, we talk about God's grace, and, you know, and I think that God's grace is available to everybody in the entire world. You know, I think the difference that happens for us Pentecost is the acceptance of God's grace. That's just really what it's about for me. It's just accepting what's in front of me to do and doing it to the best of my ability. Nobody's trying to get me, you know, and just getting out of that mindset and moving on. But anyway, I want to get started here, so I'm just going to tell you a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like for me today. I'm the oldest of four kids. My dad was a master sergeant in the Army, and that made me the automatic corporal of my family. You know, I've just always been in charge since the very beginning of time, as I know it. And my husband jokes that I came out of the womb wearing an armband and carrying a clipboard. And, you know, and he's not too far off the mark. Ever since I was a child, you know, in school, whatever, I've always been room monitor, playground monitor, cafeteria monitor, you know, because... You know, I'm just good at it. You know, if I watch someone and they're doing something wrong, I will write it down and I will report you. You know, I've got no trouble with that. And, you know, what can I say? It's a gift. And, you know, and I don't care if you're a big kid and I don't care if you're older than me. I don't care any of that stuff. You know, by God, you will be reported. And that's why I always got those kinds of jobs. And like I say, my dad was a master sergeant in the Army, so I was raised with a lot of discipline, you know, duty, honor, country. Our rooms, my sister and I, we had little bunk beds, and on our bunk beds we had Army blankets with the eagle, you know, with arrows in one hand, you know, crossed on there. We had little foot lockers at the end of our bed where we stowed our stuff, and my dad would do room inspections, and I loved it. You know, I love rules and regulations. I love knowing what is expected of you and what you are supposed to do. It just makes my world so neat and tidy, and that's how I like it to be. But then there's other people in the world, and we know who they are, and by God, they need to be reported to somebody, don't they? I mean... And I don't know why it is, because the rule followers, I never pay any attention to those people. But boy, the minute I see, you know, somebody just a little off kilter doing whatever, you know, driving down the road, the first person I notice is the one that's not staying in their lane going straight at 55 miles an hour. These people should be shot. And, you know, and I want to write down their license. And isn't it great now? Cell phones, call them, report them. I mean, it's just a wonderful world. And I'm grateful I have Al-Anon. And so should a lot of people, actually. But anyway, I grew up in this Army family, you know, and there was a lot of drinking that went on in my house, you know, and I really identified so much with what Brad was saying because, you know, I had no idea that my dad had a drinking problem or that there was even alcohol in our family. When you grow up with that, I mean, I was born into that. My dad was drinking way before I ever showed up on the scene. So that's just, you know, that was normal for me. As far as I was concerned, that's how everybody's family was, and that's just what went on. Plus, we were in the military. We always lived in military housing with other military families, and there's a lot of drinking that, especially back then, that went on in the military, you know, and a lot of moms walking around with black eyes, and nobody ever said anything about it because you don't. You know, that's just the code that goes on. And again, I had absolutely no idea that there was a problem of alcohol in our family. You know, it's like Brad said, my dad just drank, you know, he was drunk every day. He drank beer every day. You know, that was what my dad, and that's what dads do. They drink and they get drunk and they fall down or they pass out and sometimes they get mad and sometimes you get hit and sometimes you don't, and that's just the name of the tune. You know, and I didn't see that much difference going on in anybody else's house. So it was, again, normal behavior, you know, for what I grew up with. And when I was really new in Al-Anon, I went to lots and lots of Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And if you're new, and even if you're not, I cannot recommend that enough. It says in our Al-Anon literature that we should learn all we can about the disease of alcoholism. And believe you me, I don't think there's any better place than in open meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've learned so much in AA, and a lot of my program are things that I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. I count among some of my very best friends people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have a lot of gratitude towards AA. But I went to a lot of AA meetings, and I was at this one AA meeting, and it seemed to me that the speaker that evening, he, you know, when he was talking, his whole talk was about alcoholism, the family disease. Now, I don't know that that's what his whole talk was about, but that's what I heard him talk about. And he talked about alcoholism in the family, and he compared it to having a rhinoceros in your living room, but everybody pretends it's a coffee table. And that's the perfect description of the family that I grew up in, because we'd all be sitting around the dinner table, and my mom had gotten to the part where she could tell where my dad was ready to have one of his alcoholic explosions, you know, but she could never say to us kids, okay, you know, your dad's going to blow up here, so nobody say anything or do anything, because of course that would cause my father to blow up and explode. So, but what she would do, and if you grow up in an alcoholic family, you know, the first thing out the window was any form of verbal communication of any kind, you know, and my mom spoke to us facially, you know, and that's just, you know, this, a lot of this stuff going on, you know, and you, and if you grow up in an alcoholic home, you know what that means, you know, it's like red alert, you know, and, you know, so everybody tries to be good and not do anything, but of course, if you have an alcoholic who's ready to explode, it's going to happen, and sure enough, someone would do some minor infraction, scratch their knife on a plate, spill some milk, and ba-boom, you know, there would be this huge explosion, dinner would go flying, everybody gets a whooping, everybody gets sent to bed, including my mother, the dog, everybody's gone, you know, and this might just be 5:30 in the afternoon, but it's done, you know, I mean, it's a done deal, and then you get up the next morning, and you get up the courage to go into the kitchen, and there's my dad sitting with his morning glass of beer. And it's, and you walk in the kitchen and it's, good morning, what do you want for breakfast? And no one ever says, gee whiz, what was that about last night, Dad? Gee whiz, how come you had to hit everybody? How come you had to throw dinner on the floor? No one says anything because you just want it to be over. And the rhinoceros goes back to being a coffee table again. You know, and like I say, it's just the perfect description of the family that I grew up in. And again, you know, if you've ever, you know, I learned early on, you know, not to bring friends home because I never knew what was going to be going on in my house. Could come home someday and it'd be fine and wonderful. The Sarge would be just this great lovey guy. And other days you'd come home and the Sarge would be calling you every name under the sun. And, you know, and you learn not to invite your parents to school when you're getting an award, because if you've ever had a drunken parent show up at school, you know, pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization is just not reserved for the alcoholic. You know, and if you've had that experience, then you know exactly what I'm talking about. You know, and I'm not trying to say that my childhood was any worse than anybody else's. It's just a normal childhood growing up in what can be considered, you know, what it was for me, a normal alcoholic home. That was normal for me. And, you know, and I look back on the whole thing now and, you know, and it's funny, there's four kids and how different our reactions, all four of us, you know, the different roles that we all took on in dealing with and coping with, you know, the family disease of alcoholism. You know, what I know today is I think everybody just does the very best they can with what information that they have. You know, I had a lot of issues about my childhood when I got into Al-Anon, a lot of blaming, a lot of anger towards my mother who was not a drunk and my father who was, and I resented both my parents equally when I got here. But, you know, my sponsor, you know, made me write about it. And I had to write a lot of things about my dad and my mom and all the stuff that went on. And when I was all done, you know, and we prayed about it and we did the things that we learned to do here about, you know, I still had a lot of anger. And so my sponsor said, you know, we're done with this, you know, this. My dad had since passed away. My dad died of alcoholism at 55. He died the death they talk about in the big books of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, total insanity and death. It was not pretty. I can't tell you the last words my dad said to me because they were so obscene, but my dad was tied down, totally insane, and you know, and he just died that horrible death. And but anyway, I still, even after he was gone, had a lot of anger about it. And you know, and my sponsor, you know, turned this program for me to work, you know, to get over that stuff. And what she finally had me do, she says, you know, we've done all we can do on the anger. Now it's time to start getting grateful. You know, and I didn't think I'd ever be grateful for my father. And she said, well, I want you to think of something, one good thing your dad did. And I said, there isn't one good thing. She goes, you go home, you think about it, think about it, think about it, you know. And I did, and sure enough, I came up with the fact that my dad did teach me how to drive. You know, and if you're going to live in Southern California and marry your own alcoholic, that's really something that, you know, you got to be able to drive. And So I came up with that. She says, okay, you know, you've done the work. You've done everything you can. Now it's time that when, you know, those thoughts start, you know, rising up in you, you think about the fact that your father taught you how to drive, you know, and you start replacing that anger with some gratitude. And so when I would have these unwholesome emotions start to develop up in me, knowing that I've done all the work that I could do on it, I would think my dad taught me how to drive. And it was amazing because after that, I thought up a second thing that my dad did. And then I thought up a third thing. And then I thought up a fourth thing. And, you know, and now what I know today is that my dad suffered from a disease I'm sure he would rather not have suffered from. You know, my dad died of alcoholism. And he paid the ultimate price. And how much longer am I going to punish him? Or shit, how much longer am I going to punish myself? Al-Anon has never told me that it's okay that my dad was a drunk and that he was mean and that he hit us or any of that stuff. Al-Anon's just taught me, you know, that happened. Now what are you going to do about it? You know, as Ajit was talking about, it's moving from the problem into the solution. That's where you get to walk out. You know, that's exactly where you get to walk out of the deal. But anyway, my dad got out of the Army when I was about 12 or 13 years old, and we moved to Southern California. Now, all this time before, we'd lived in Europe, and we'd lived in the eastern United States, and this was in the early 60s. So getting out of the Army and then moving to Southern California in the 60s, I mean, this was like we'd been better off going to Mars. I mean, it was such a bizarre world, and everybody's all hippy-dippy, lovey-dovey, and not many rules and regulations going on for a little girl like me, And so I had a little bit of an adjustment to make, but up until this time, you know, I'm a rule and regulation person. I get straight A's in school. I do exactly what is expected of me. I keep my nose clean, and I stay out of the sergeant's way as much as possible. And, you know, and I'm a pretty easygoing, you know, kid about all this stuff, just, you know, nose to the grindstone, rules and regulations, you know, everything right down to the letter. And then I'm 17 years old, and I meet my husband. I should have known there was something really wrong with him because my dad liked him right away. And but that went right over my head. And we went out on this date, and I tried not to beat him at bowling, but it was impossible. And I cleaned his clock at bowling, and then we're going back to his house, and we've gone out with this other couple, and my husband's a few years older than me because he was about 23 at the time, and I'm 17, and we go back to his house, and he's been married once before, living back again with his mom and dad. Might have been clue number two to me that there was something wrong with them, but that went right over my head. And I remember on the way back to his house, he stops at a liquor store, and he asked me what I want to drink. Well, I'm 17 years old, and there's rules and regulations about drinking in the state of California, you know, and I tell him all this stuff, and, you know, he seems totally unimpressed, and he went in and got a gallon of Red Mountain wine, if nothing else, to impress me what he could consume in sheer volume alone in one evening. And we went in and got this wine, we went back to his house, and we drank this wine, and that's when I, you know, got drunk, first time I ever really gotten, you know, drunk, and what I remember the most about that night, even to this day, is what an absolutely great, fabulous time I had. You know, all my experience up into drinking then had just been, it's negative. I mean, it's just fighting and anger and meanness and cruelty, and I watched my husband drink, and he just got happy. You know, he just loves to be, you know, he's a happy guy when he's drinking. He's fun to be around. He wants to go do fun stuff. He doesn't want to fight or hit anybody. He wants to kiss you, you know. And I mean, he just wants to have a good old time. And it, you know, and it was really enjoyable. And it was just like, and it opened up this whole new world to me. You know, I'd always said I'd never marry anybody like my dad. And I didn't marry anybody like my dad. I married somebody who suffers from the disease of alcoholism like my dad. But that's where the similarities between my husband and my father ceased, because my husband, you know, my dad liked to, you know, just hit you and just be mad and angry all the time, and my husband just liked to get drunk, lay down, pass out. Now, I shared that one time from the podium, and Hank J. was sitting in the front row next to my husband, and he leaned over to Butch, and he said, "Butch, I don't think that's too much to ask for." And and he said it loud enough so I could hear him too, the little booger, but but it was more than I could give him, that's for absolutely sure. You know, and in the beginning, you know, from the very beginning that I started dating my husband, it was drinking and drugs. He was right out there. He never hid any of that kind of stuff for me. You know, and I participated in the drinking. I would never do the drugs because those are illegal in the state. You know, those are illegal everywhere, and I just don't do anything that's illegal of any way, shape, or form. But anyway, you know, but he was always in my face with that stuff. It was just right there. This is what I do. This is how I drink. These are drugs I take. You can like it or you cannot like it, but this is me. You know, and when I walked into Al-Anon the very first time, you know, if you would have said to me, "Larsine, did you have any idea that Butch was drinking or doing drugs and, you know, as much as he was doing?" The day I walked into my first Al-Anon meeting, I absolutely would have denied that I had any idea. Even though I share with you honestly today, you know, that it was always right up there and in my face. And why? Because I believe that that's how I, the non-drinker, am affected by the disease of alcoholism. When things get too hard for me, me to look at. When I have to accept some responsibility for what's going on, then I just look the other way. I don't know. Then I pretend I don't know what's going on. I don't know if it's a self-defense mechanism or whatever, but I know that's how I'm affected by the disease of alcoholism, you know, because it's very important for me to be in the right place all the time. You know, and I don't, again, know why this thinking ever occurred to me. I always call it information from nowhere. You know, and I get a lot of information from nowhere because I think a lot. You know, and what happens is I think up all, and all this information, for whatever reason, lands in my head. And because I think it, it becomes fact for me. You know, and somewhere in very, very beginning, you know, this was the fact. Larsen good, Butch bad. You know, I mean, that's just, and again, you know, just because he started doing things, and somewhere in there, I became the good guy, and he became the bad guy, and all his behaviors were bad, and all my behaviors were good, even though I had no justification for that. I never talk to people about what's going on in my house. God forbid they should know what's going on. So I'm getting all my help from me, you know, which is a very scary thing, because I'm my worst enemy, you know, so there's a real conflict going on there from the very beginning for me. But anyway, Butch and I started going out, and we were just partying, having a great old time, and he was a, you know, heavy-duty drinker from the beginning. He was a blackout drinker from the beginning, which I have never understood, and he's a disappearing drunk from the very beginning. We'd go out and have a wonderful time 3 or 4 times, then he'd be gone 6, 7, 8 days. Nobody would know where the heck he was, you know, and then one morning I'd go out to work, and there he would be in the back seat of my car, sound asleep. You know, he would have breath that would knock a camel off of its feet, but it never bothered me. He just came to see me first, and that's all that ever mattered. Back then, I never said, where you been, what were you doing, nothing. He was just there, and that's all I needed to know. He came to see me first, you know, and it got to where if he was missing for more than 24 hours, I started leaving a blanket and a pillow in the back seat of the car, because right away I'm taken care of. Right away I'm, you know, doing all that kind of stuff. And, you know, and anyway, Butch and I, you know, we dated for a while, and we were dated for about a couple of years. And what ended up happening is that I got pregnant. You know, and I share this with you because later on when our lives got really, really bad behind the alcoholism, you know, I was sure it was because God was punishing me, because I'm the big rule regulation person, and now I'd broken the big rule and the big regulation, and this was the big punishment from above. You know, I was in Al-Anon for a while before someone told me, you know, Larsen, if you screw around and don't use any birth control, you might just get pregnant. You know, it's just a fact of life. But boy, if you're blaming God for everything that's going on in your life, you know, isn't that a built-in excuse, you know, to suffer? You know, that's how it was for me, because one more time, you know, I think I'm the big responsibility person, but every time I have to look at my responsibility in a situation, you know, then I make an excuse, oh, God's punishing me. That's why this stuff is happening to me. Therefore, there's nothing that I can do about it. I think the first thing that alcoholism robbed me of was my ability to know that I have choices. And I don't care what your situation is or what's going on in your life. You know, what I'm here to tell you today is that you always have a choice. Granted, it may not be a pleasant one. It may not be one you're really, the road you really wanted to go down, but there's always a choice. Sometimes they're very hard choices and hard things to do, but they are always there. You're not stuck anywhere unless you want to be stuck. You know, and I'm so grateful that I got to learn that here. But sometimes it's scary. Sometimes it's very, very scary. But anyway, I got pregnant, and about a month after our son was born, we got married. And I don't care if it's a big deal for you. It was a huge deal for me, huge. And, you know, it's all I thought about most of the time, you know. And occasionally after Butch and I were married, I would have to take him to one of my work functions. And all the way to this work function, I would tell him, now, when they ask you when we were married, you tell them blah, 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 so it all works out in the chronological order that I know you so desperately wanted to work out in. And I don't know how many parties you've been to yet, but you know, when I introduce Butch, you know, and they go, Butch, it's nice to meet you, no one ever said, Butch, what year did you and Larsen get married? You know, I mean, never once has it happened. You know, we've been married almost 29 years now, and he doesn't even know how long we've been married anymore. I mean, it's just every time someone talks to him now, he kind of looks at me, you know, like, okay, what do I say? You know, and you reap what you sow. That's all I know about that. It's okay, honey, you tell him whatever you want now, but anyway, it was a huge deal for me. And when I was in Al-Anon my first year, we have our AFG convention in Southern California, which is our Al-Anon Family Groups convention. And we go to it, and we do the thing where we get the two adjoining hotel rooms, and we cram as many women in these two hotel rooms. And one night we're at the meeting, or we're up in the room, and we're having the meeting after the meeting. You know, and there's seven of us in this room. And again, we're sharing, and the circle's going around. And it seems to me that everybody's telling everybody their deepest, darkest secret. Now, I don't know that that that's what was shared, but that's what I heard. And so when it came around to my turn, I shared how I had had to get married because I was pregnant. Well, there's seven of us in the room. Turns out six of them had to get married because they were pregnant. And we decided the seventh was the sickest because she married an alcoholic and didn't have to. And so, you know, again, you're as sick as your secrets here, you know, and you know, and again, what a freedom, you know, what an absolute freedom that was for me that night, because, you know, I carried that little thing, and in my head, my information from nowhere, I kept making, you know, that bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger in my life, to the point that, you know, when this son celebrated his birthday, it was a hugely uncomfortable day for me. Just reminded me of my big fat mistake, you know. And I took this little child and tried to pin this crap on a little bitty kid. And I'm not the drinker, you know, but this is how I'm affected by the disease of alcoholism. I look at alcoholism as probably about the most negative thing that's going on. And all that active alcoholism generates in a family, be it the drinker, the non-drinker, the kids, whoever, is just more negativity, you know. And I am a perfect example of that, you know. And you know, and this is a loving, gentle, wonderful child, you know, who's now 29 years old, you know, and to think, that I was willing to pin all this stuff on a little bitty kid who had absolutely nothing to do with any of it. And again, I don't tell you this stuff because I'm proud of it. I tell you this because this is where the disease of alcoholism took me, and I'm not even the person that's drinking. And I think I'm doing pretty damn good holding it all together, being the strong one, being the good parent, you know, building the ego on the one hand. I mean, it's insidious. It's just absolutely crazy how we get, and I don't know, you know, again, I wish I could explain it, and I don't know, but it's just the disease of alcoholism and how it's affected me. But anyway, Butch and I got married, and right after we got married, you know, the day after we got married, to be specific, I decided to tell him the rules and regulations of the marriage. And I sat him in our kitchen chair and told him the rules and regulations of the marriage. We're married now. We have responsibilities, obligations. This partying thing is fun, but once a month we will go out from now on. We'll get a babysitter, and once a month we can go out and party. After that, it's work, work, work. We're going to save. We're going to buy a house. We're going to do all this stuff. Butch sat in the chair. Do you understand the rules and regulations of the marriage? He did this, you know, which to me was affirmative. What I know now, he was just so flaming loaded. His head was just going like this. And you know, and we were off, because day number two of our marriage, he doesn't come home all night long, you know. And let me tell you, the war was on. I watched my mom for years do the silent treatment with my dad. I knew that didn't work. I am proud to stand before you and tell you my husband begged for the silent treatment. He never got it, not one time. He'd come in the door, and I was like a little, like a, you know, little dogs, just, you know, I was just all just yip, 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 yip. You know, and like I said, he just wanted to lay down and pass out. He'd be, you know, passing out. I'd be picking him up back by the shoulders, you know, because by God, I wasn't done telling him what it was I had to say. And, you know, he jokes I talk as fast as I do, because I only had so much time from when he came home to when he passed out to tell him everything it was. Because by God, he was going to hear it. And there was just going to be, I wasn't going to put up with any of this crap. And I wasn't going to let him intimidate me or scare me or do any of those things that I had grown up with. And I just wasn't going to have it. I just absolutely wasn't going to have it. Wasn't going to have what I didn't know, but I wasn't going to have it. And again, information from nowhere. I don't know what's going on. I'm not quite sure what I'm battling, you know, or what the deal is or anything else like that. But again, it's the disease of alcoholism. You know, I want you to know the fact that we had a child was positively the driving force behind Butch and I getting married. But I also want you to know that the day that Butch and I got married, that I believe I love my husband and I believe that he loved me. That we took marriage vows, that we were really sincere about taking that day. He was sober that day and so was I. And we stood up there before a minister, and I believe that we really do, when we did those vows that day, want to honor and love and cherish, take care of each other, do all the things, you know, that everybody wants to do the day that they get married. But it wasn't just Butch and Larsine that got married that day. There was the disease of alcoholism, you know. And I stand before you and I'll let you know, alcoholism doesn't love or cherish anything. Alcoholism means to tear your family apart, and it doesn't care how it does it. You know, and so what does it with that negativity, anger, fear, doubt, you know, all those things that come into play when you're dealing with it, with active alcoholism. But anyway, you know, Butch and I were off on this thing, and like I say, it was like from the very beginning. I can't say we had any kind of romantic period at all, because then I just knew from the very beginning I had to watch him. You know, I've got to watch him 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's my job, and that's what I'm going to do, and I'll stick to it. You know, and I will fix him, and I will make him be who I want him to be and act like I want him to act. And again, whatever gave me that power, why did I want those things? I don't know. Information from nowhere landed here, and I thought that was my job, you know, to make him be who I want him to be, act like I want him to act, do the things. I never wanted him not to drink. I wanted him to drink, like I said, he wanted his wife to drink. Cup. I didn't want him to drink white Chardonnay. He's not gay. I wanted him to have... I wanted him to come home and have two Budweisers. That's what I wanted him to do, you know, and then... You know, tell me how much he loved me, how good dinner was, and, you know, and all the rest of the stuff. You know, that's what I wanted him to do. I don't know why I thought that was the secret ingredient of life. Too many beer commercials, I guess. I don't know. You know, again, information from nowhere that became fact for me, you know. And Butch and I just took off on this, you know, the wild ride of the disease of alcoholism. And, you know, and he got progressively worse, like it talks about in the book. And one night he came home and he woke me up, which shows you how drunk he was, you know. And he demanded to have his dinner, and he had never done anything like that. Scared the bejeebies out of me, you know. And so, you know, because he was really kind of gruff, and he'd never had done that before. And I kind of scurried into the kitchen. This is like 2 o'clock in the morning. But then as I was in the kitchen, I woke up, and I remembered who he was dealing with. And... And I made this Mexican casserole that called for one jalapeno pepper, but of course I had a whole can of those little puppies in there, so I just cut up every single one of those peppers and stuffed it in there. He's so drunk he ate it. You know, his mouth must have been on flaming fire. And then he did what I wanted him to do, and that was go in the bathroom and puke his brains out. You know, because I don't know how you feel, but when my alcoholic throws up, I get a warm feeling all over. It just, it lasts me for days, you know. I mean... You know, and this is where we are in the first year of our marriage, you know. I mean, it's just, you know, I'm in the bedroom, you know, he's puking his brains out, and I'm giggling in my pillow in the bedroom, you know, because he messed with me, you know. And again, you know, where does this thinking come from? You know, where does this stuff happen? How does it happen? I didn't start out that way. I didn't think the day we got married, oh, I can't wait till I get to make him puke day comes, you know, but that's where it gets to. That's where it gets to. And it's this slow-moving, insidious disease of alcoholism and how I'm affected by it, and I'm not even the person that's drinking. You know, it's just the way that this ride takes us, and I still stand back and look. You know, I love in our literature where it talks about how we become nervous and irritable without knowing it. You know, to me, the key words are without knowing it. How do you get irritable and nervous without knowing it? I don't know, but it happened to me. And why? Because we try and force solutions. That's all I was ever trying to do from the very beginning. I know I just need to fix this. I don't care how I fix it. I don't care who I hurt how I fix it. I just know I need to fix it. And so I'm constantly forcing. My whole life is nothing but trying to make round, you know, things go in square, you know, other things. And that's just, again, where does that information come from? Why do I act on it all the time? Why do I feel like I have to fix it right away and make it better right away? You know, who put me in charge of everybody on the face of the earth? I don't know. But again, information from nowhere lands here and becomes fact for me, and I think I have to do something about it. You know, so anyway, you know, the stuff just went on, and, you know, my husband's drinking got worse and worse and scarier and scarier. And, you know, and again, I'm always trying to fix it. One night he's laying in bed, passed out. I spent half the night whispering in his ear, you don't want to drink. You just want to work and give Larsine the money. And that's important, too. You know, and I mean, and again, information from nowhere. I never said, well, to someone, you know, I saw it on an episode of The Flintstones, to be perfectly honest with you. And, you know, but I'll try it. That's because at this point I'm willing to do anything or go anywhere except to look for any kind of outside help. Because God forbid anybody knows that my house isn't perfect or that my husband has any kind of a problem. And again, I don't know that it's drinking. You know, I don't know that it's drinking. I think that it's just lack of willpower. You know, because I have been probably to thousands of Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. I've heard fabulous AA speakers talk, and they can talk to me till the cows come home. I'm never going to understand the compulsion to drink because it is not mine. You know, I'm not an alcoholic. I can take a drink or not take a drink. And the fact that I could do that caused a lot of pain in our family. Because I could do that, then why can't he? If he loves me, why does he keep doing this stuff over and over again? If he loves our family, you know, if he cares about us like he says he does, why does he keep doing this stuff over and over again? You know, if drinking, you know, interfered with my relationship with him or the kids, I'd give it up in a heartbeat. But how easy to say when you can give up something in a heartbeat? You know, I had no idea that alcoholism is a disease. And as he just said, I don't care why it is or what it is or if it is or if it isn't. All I know is my husband suffers from alcoholism, and that's all that I need to know today. It's good enough for me. It should have been good enough for me then. But again, I had absolutely no idea that I was dealing with the disease of alcoholism. When I was new in Al-Anon, I had a really good friend, Crazy Gene, and he used to talk all over, and he asked me to go be his 10-minute speaker with him at this place he was talking. And I was new in Al-Anon. I didn't know what you were supposed to talk about. So I talked the whole 10 minutes about how well I hid the disease of alcoholism from all our family and friends, because I was new and I thought you're supposed to brag on yourself. And I thought that was pretty good. And when I sat down, my friend Crazy Gene got up there and he said, you know, the only people that didn't know there was the disease of alcoholism in Butch and Larsine's house were Butch and Larsine. You know, it's the disease of denial. I don't want to look at it, so I just pretend it's not there and I'll look at something else. You know, I spent a lot of time yelling at my husband, screaming at my husband. I'm not proud of that. You know, and oftentimes I would hear, you know, I could see in my husband's eyes, looking into his eyes, the pain for me calling him the names, making him feel bad about what he said, what he did. You know, I could tell he was genuinely sorry, genuinely remorseful for everything that had happened. Larsine, I promise I'll never do it again. And when he said those things, I know that he meant it with every fiber of his being. And I would hear the little voice in the back of my head going, leave him alone. Don't punish him anymore. Quit hurting him with your words. But then there's that other part of me that's just like, no, you can't let up. You got to ride hard. Keep forcing this solution. Make him feel bad about how he is, because then maybe that way you can control him. And again, how I'm affected by the disease of alcoholism, and I'm not even the person that's drinking. How do you justify that kind of behavior when you're not even the person that's drinking? You know, and to me, you know, I think about, justifiable anger. You know, that's as deadly to me as the first drink is to the alcoholic. You know, but there's lots of reasons to be mad all the time, you know, and I just jumped on that, you know, and we've heard, you know, two wrongs never make a right. But see, in the beginning, his wrongs were always so big. They were just these huge things, and it seems the things that I did were really kind of small in comparison. But it wasn't very long before my wrongs got to be just as big as his. And again, how I'm affected by the disease of alcoholism, and I'm not even the person that's drinking. But anyway, you know, we just went through this thing. We had another kid. Obviously, he didn't have enough responsibility. We should have another child. You know, these are just, you know, all, you know, that we did Ann abuse. God, we did everything and anything. I thought Ann abuse was great because it's a pill. He likes pills. This might work. And, you know, and so I got him to take Ann abuse for a couple of years. And he didn't drink for a whole 2-year period while he was taking Ann abuse. You know, but I'll tell you what, you know, what we got rid of that. We got rid of the alcohol, but the ism was alive and well. You know, what my husband ended up doing was doing an exorbitant amount of drugs in its place, because I took away his drug of choice, which was alcohol. You know, and all I know is that nothing changed and everything just kept getting progressively worse and progressively worse. And towards the very, very end of my husband's drinking, I remember us standing toe-to-toe with him, just yelling, just so angry, just so full of rage. I could see nothing. I was full of hatred, just pissed off to beat the band. And I'm standing toe-to-toe with my husband, and I became very, very conscious of our two little boys, who at that point were about 5 and 3 years old, and they're standing on either side of me, yanking on my pant legs. You know, and I look down at these little boys, and they're just sobbing and crying, Mommy, Mommy, please stop yelling at Daddy. You know, and I would like to tell you I had a moment of clarity then, but I absolutely did not. What I did was I became enraged at those children. How dare they tell me to stop yelling at their dad? He's the reason we're in the situation we are. He's the reason there's so much anger and hatred and all this stuff going on in our family. And by the time I get done yelling at these two little boys, I watch their drunken father walking out the front door. And I, the sober mother, say to the drunken father, where the hell do you think you're going? And the drunken father turns to the sober mother and says, I'm leaving because we're upsetting the children. And again, I don't tell you the story. This is where the disease of alcoholism took me. You know, and I'm the sober mom. I'm the sober parent who's holding it all together. And I think I'm pretty much unaffected. I think I'm doing a pretty good job if you'd ask me on the side, you know, holding this whole deal together. And again, how I'm affected by the disease of alcoholism. And somewhere in all this insanity, I went to my very first Al-Anon meeting. And it was a great Al-Anon meeting, I'm sure. It was at the old Hermosa Beach Alano Club, which is no longer there, actually Manhattan Beach Alano Club. And they had all this great literature on the table and nice people in the meeting. And I sat in the front row, and they talked about what they could do for me, what I could do for me and my children. And they said, if somebody's drinking bothers you, then you should be here. Now, I'm here to tell you, if you're new and you don't want to be here, you will find a reason not to be here. And when they said, if somebody's drinking bothers you, then Al-Anon's for you. Well, right away, I knew I didn't belong. Al-Anon works if somebody's drinking bothers you. His drinking pissed me off. And there's a whole nother level of nirvana there, you know, and stuff. Do you have Al-Anon pissed off people meetings? Because that's where I need to be, you know. Flies bother me, you know. I can deal with being bothered. I wish I was just bothered, you know, but... You know, and again, because I didn't want to be there, because you wanted to talk about what I could do for myself and what I could do for my children. You know, when I said, I'm sitting in that front row, Larsine, do you want your life to be different? God, did I want my life to be different? Larsine, what are you willing to do about it? I wasn't willing to do anything about it because it wasn't my problem. You fix him and I'll be okay. That's all you need to do. You just tell me how to get him sober, and then I'll be just perfectly fine. You know, and they gave me all the literature, but they didn't give me the piece of literature I wanted, which is how to get him to stop drinking and do what you want them to do, because that's all that I was interested in. I really try and get our group. I wanted to make one up on the computer just to cover, just to suck the newcomers in a little longer, you know. We'll give this to you after 6 months. Then we'll give you the second page, you know. It would have kept me coming back for 6 months, I'll tell you that much. But, you know, but that's what I wanted to know, and, you know, and you weren't willing to give me that. So what ended up happening is my husband ended up getting arrested for drunk driving. No big deal. My husband's been arrested lots and lots of times for drunk driving. You know, his last drunk, on a scale of 1 to 10, I wouldn't even give it a 5. You know why that's the one that got him sober? I have absolutely no idea. But... But anyway, he ended up getting sober that night. And again, I have absolutely no idea why. But I had heard about this hospital program that they had just opened down the road from us. And I'd called up this hospital, told them about my situation. And they told me I could have my husband committed if he were drunk, but that after he sobered up, if he didn't want to stay, they wouldn't keep him. Because they weren't interested in, you know, just, they were interested in people that wanted to get sober. And if he didn't want to stay, he didn't have to. And they gave me the number of the doctor on call. Thank you very much. And that was that. And then about 2 o'clock in the morning, the phone rings, and it's the Redondo Beach Police, and they have my husband in custody one more time. No big deal again for me. It happens all the time. But the next morning when I went to go pick him up, there was something very, very different. And I know that God was working in Butch's life, even though I don't know that God was necessarily working in mine. Because I went to pick him up that morning, and he didn't say anything, you know. And usually he was pretty ticked off about the police arresting a law-abiding citizen like himself, you know, and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, and usually I had a heck of a lot to say too, you know. And believe you me, I didn't say anything. And believe you me, it takes a power greater than anything you've seen in your life to keep my mouth shut. And I just picked him up, and he got in the car, and he didn't say anything, and I didn't say anything, you know. But we did have to spend about 45 minutes that morning truck hunting. I don't know if you do that out in Texas, but I think it ought to be an Al-Anon Olympic event. How they lose entire vehicles is amazing to me, just amazing. Talk about out of the rules and regulations category. But anyway, we found his truck. We went home. He went upstairs 2 whole days. Didn't come down. I didn't go up. And then when he came downstairs, you know, the understatement of the year from the alcoholic, I think I have a drinking problem, you know, and really. And so I handed him the number of this doctor that was on call at the hospital that day. You know, and again, God working in Butch's life, because I didn't make the call. I didn't place the call. I didn't stay in the room while he made the call. I made sure I was far away so I didn't hear any of it. And that is as foreign to me as anything. And I believe with all my heart that Butch made a decision and surrendered that night that he was arrested, and that God literally, to help Butch, pushed me as far out of the way as he possibly could so that my husband could find his sobriety. And my husband went into this hospital, and they had a 28-day thing. But first he had to go into the psychiatric unit of the hospital because he had to detox from all the Valium and alcohol and all that kind of good stuff. And I remember as I was leaving him in the psychiatric unit, there's these big double doors way at the end of the hallway, and I'm walking out, and he calls my name. And I'm sure it's because he's changed his mind, which is perfectly fine with me now, because I'm not too thrilled about leaving my husband in a psychiatric hospital. What will the neighbor say? You know. And so I walk back to him, and he reaches into his pocket, and he handed me the Valium that he brought in case of emergency. You know, and he'd never parted with a Valium in his life. And I went home and I took it because I was just a basket case. And I slept for like 15 hours straight, too. Let me tell you, boy, the stuff is. But anyway, and, you know, and he's, you know, this is where we are now. And I've got a husband in the psychiatric unit, and I've got a son in kindergarten and one in preschool. And to cheer my husband up, I would take him, you know, what the boys had made in preschool and kindergarten, you know. But no, no, he wanted to show me what he made in occupational therapy that day, you know. I'd take it home, show the boys, we'd hang it on the refrigerator. Look what Daddy did. We're so proud, you know. Woohoo, sobriety, yeah. And I didn't know what to expect. I mean, I really, it was weird. It was absolutely strange-o, nutso, wacko. And after 2 weeks in the psychiatric unit, they put him on the, you know, the alcoholism side of this program in this hospital, and he started going to Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, and I'm very proud to report to you, my husband has maintained his sobriety, and that was July the 21st, 1979, to this date. And my gratitude to Alcoholics Anonymous knows absolutely no bounds. You know, because my husband was... my husband was very close to death when he got sober. And I would come home and he would be totally passed out. Over, you know, I was always afraid, you know, so much drugs, so much alcohol, just gone. And I was always so afraid he was going to OD and die, but I'd be afraid to call the paramedics because of the drug use. And just not knowing, every day coming home thinking this is the day your husband, you're going to find him dead. It's not a fun place to be, you know. And I don't cry because he almost died, because at that point I was rooting for death. I was, die, sucker, and let me out, because, I, you know, if somebody said, why didn't you divorce him? I'm like, and let him win? I don't think so. No, the only way he's getting out of here is feet first, and, you know, but I have tears because I think about if my husband had died, you know, the anger that I was totally consumed with. If he would have died, I just see myself as a very angry woman raising up a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old. What kind of family you think that would have been? What kind of children do you think those would have been today? And that's why my gratitude is so great. Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon have healed my family, and we have a loving family today, and it's because of the program, and thus my tears. Anyway, he got sober, and I thought it was great. I was happy, la, la, la. They said, you know, they didn't have any big family intensive therapy stuff going on there. They just said, you should go to an Al-Anon meeting. So I'm a rule follower, so I went to a Al-Anon meeting. And my attitude at that meeting was, you know, I came to you guys 3 years ago, asked you how to get my husband sober, didn't tell me squat ola. And now my husband's sober, and I'm not going to tell you how I did it. You know, and... I know, arrogance beyond belief. Again, information from nowhere lands here. I mean, I don't know what I did, but I was sure I did it and fully willing to take credit for it. So he's going to AA, you know, and I'm not going to Al-Anon. And I'm helpful. You know how helpful I am. I go with him the first 6 months to help him hear the stuff he needs to hear. And, you know, but after 6 months, I got tired of going to AA. I'm like, holy crap, you know, there's only 12 steps. How stupid are you? Let's go, Jack. You know, this is not, you know, but he made it clear to me, Alcoholics Anonymous is the most important thing, you know, in his life. And he's going to AA. I could like it or not like it, but that's what he was going to do. And he started working a program and going to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I started resenting Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I didn't like the fact that he was going to meetings. I didn't like the fact that AA women were hugging on him and kissing him and telling me how freaking wonderful he was. You know, I mean, it was just, spare me, you know. Because, boy, they get sober, and aren't they wonderful now? Boy, everybody loves them. Yay for the alcoholic. Ooh, aren't you lucky, Larsine? Yeah, I felt real lucky, all right. And you know, and what it was for me, you know, it's like, you know, I was lucky, but I didn't want to look at that. You know, I've always been the good guy here. I've always been the hero of the family. I've always been saving this spot in life for Butch to get well and get sober. You know, and the scary part was is that he was getting sober, and he was working these principles in his life, and he was bringing these principles home to our family. And it became very, very scary for me. Because he was making a better person of himself. His heart was getting bigger, and mine wasn't. Mine wasn't changing at all. Because I can go to AA meetings till the cows come home, and I hear a lot of wonderful things at Alcoholics Anonymous, but I am not an alcoholic, and my recovery does not lie in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. My recovery lies in the rooms of Al-Anon, and that's where I need to go to get well for me. And But anyway, he was coming home, you know, Mr. Happy Sober AA guy. And it just about, ooh, just grated my cheese. And that he was having such a gay old wonderful time. And I was just, you know, but again, I just didn't know how to turn it off. I just didn't know how not to be mad anymore. And it's like my friend Crazy Jean says, they get sober and you're out of a job. You know, and that's just what it was for me. I was just out of this job, and I didn't know what to do or how to do. All I knew how to do was be mad. I know how to react. I know how to be angry. And so, you know, and he would just work his program. Larsine, you need to let go and let God. Larsine, easy does it. You know, I just wanted to take a wooden spoon and just stab it right through his sober little heart. You know, it was just, you know, what, you know, all of a sudden he's the good guy telling me all this stuff. And I just didn't know how to turn it off. You know, we went on this road, you know, he was sober almost 2 years and we were going to go to this conference down in Palm Springs and I couldn't let him go alone because I knew there were going to be alcoholic women running around in bikinis there, you know, and I had to go protect him. And so, you know, I went with him and he tricked me into going to the family meeting, you know, and that's where the miracle happened. For me, you know, that I was able to open up my ears and hear because I heard an Al-Anon speaker, an Alateen speaker, and an AA speaker. And it was a family meeting, but they weren't a family. They were just three, an Al-Anon, an alcoholic, and an Alateen, not related at all. But they each shared a part of their story, you know, which showed me just whatever. It just happened for me that morning, you know. And so when that conference was over and we were on our way back home, you know, I told Butch I wanted to go to Al-Anon, and, you know, and I'm really fortunate. And then when I came to Al-Anon that time, I came for all the right reasons. I didn't come to get an alcoholic sober. He was already sober. I didn't come to keep him sober. He was doing fine on his own. I came because I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. And I'm a rule and regulation person. I went to the meetings. They say we read the literature. We go to meetings. You know, hallelujah. We work the steps. Sign me up. You know, I got all the books, got the sponsor, did all that stuff. I'm ready to go. And I just leaped into it. I got a sponsor right away. You know, I know lots of people that are in Al-Anon for years and years and still don't have a sponsor because they're looking for somebody just like them. How stupid can you be? Why in the heck do you want somebody just like you to be your sponsor? They know your stuff if they're just like you. You know, you don't, you know, I want loopholes. I want ways out. When I got my first sponsor, I picked someone absolutely the opposite of me. I picked someone that was older than my mother, who had never had sobriety in her home, who was divorced from her alcoholic, who didn't have children, and she talked with a thick Dutch accent. You could hardly understand a bloody word she said. You know, and this, I love, this is exactly what I wanted to do. I remember the very first time I used her as a sponsor. Butch had a dead battery that morning, and he wanted me to jump him. So when I went down with my car, and I jumped his truck, and then he ran out of gas. And this made him angry, you know, and he yelled. And I used to say he yelled at me. You know, what I know is it just made him angry, and he yelled. And I've learned in the program it's okay to be angry. You just don't live there for 27 and a half years if you can help it, you know. And so, and it's okay, you know. But he yelled, so I did what I always do. I yelled right back at him. He stormed off to work. I went upstairs, called my sponsor, and reported his behavior, you know. And told her exactly what had happened. And after I was done, she says, when Butch gets home, you tell him you're sorry for what you said. You said. I'm like, whoa, 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 whoa. This is America. Jeannie doesn't know how we do things in America. And, you know, and she missed the crucial who started it, which I always think is so important. But I didn't want to tell her that she was stupid, so I started telling her the story over again. Obviously, she wasn't listening and missed these crucial details. And halfway through the second telling, she stopped me and she said, don't repeat the story. I heard you the first time, and don't ever, ever call me again and start a conversation with Butch said or Butch did. I don't care what Butch said or Butch did. I'm not Butch's sponsor. I am Larsine's sponsor. And for the unkind and unnecessary words that came out of her mouth, she owes her husband an amends. I'll see you at the meeting tonight. Click, goodbye, end the conversation. You know, I've learned valuable lessons from that. Never call your sponsor first thing in the morning. You got all day long to think about what she told you, you know. Never call your sponsor when you're going to see her that night, because she's going to want to know if you follow direction, you know. And I'm a rule and regulation person. I have no choice. I have to do this. So I got all day long to think about that. So when Butch came in that night and he walked in the door, I walked up to him and I told him I was sorry I let his shitty attitude affect me the way that it had. And that I would try and do better in the future. Now, I know that that's not the best amends that you can make, but what you need to know is that's the first time I ever told my husband I was sorry for anything. You know, and all we talk about here is progress, not perfection. You know, I was this much willing to do something different. And I'm here to tell you, if you're new, you only have, I don't care, you're new, you're old, you only have to have this much willingness. But there has to be some willingness. How can anything be different if you're not willing to do something different? And we think that we have to leap into it, you know, and be, and you know, like the big, wonderful amends. And therefore, if we don't make the big, wonderful amends right off the top, that we're, the program's not working for us. It's nothing to do with it at all. Nowhere in our book does it say anything about fast or quick or whatever. It says we progress at our own rate and pace. And I was this much willing to do something different. And because I became just this much willing, I could move forward. You know, and I could learn to do better amends, you know, and I could, now it seems a little bit easier even today for me to recognize my part in things when they go wrong, because I was this much willing. And every morning I get up and I try and remember, I got to have at least this much willingness so that I can make some kind of progress today. That's the gift you guys have given me, just this much willingness. But I'm here to tell you, I see people beat themselves out of this program all the time because they're not getting it fast enough. It's not working in my life. I'm not getting the results that I want. You know, you are getting the results. There's sometimes they're just really difficult to see. They're hard to see because we progress it this much. But this is how it goes. This is the way. But that's how you get there. That's exactly how it's worked for me. That's how I've gotten there, just this much at a time. But just that willingness to put that one foot in front of the other and take a risk and say something. You know, and it's just kind of how it's been for us. You know, I want to, you know, our life, you know, in AA and Al-Anon has been absolutely wonderful. You know, my husband works a wonderful program, but it's his program to work. You know, I work the best program that I can because it's my program to work. And then when we come together in our home, we each work a program, you know, and try and treat each other the way that we want to be treated, the way that you guys have taught us to be. You know, our life is good because of the lessons that you have given me. It always amazes me that I had to come to a room full of strangers to learn how to love my own family, but that's exactly how it's worked for me. And, you know, and at least how you think that I'm that we're this perfect little family walking down the street all the time. I know I look like I ooze serenity and that I always say the right thing at all times, but when I was, this is about 6 years ago, and at that point I was about 15 years in Al-Anon. And my husband and I had been to a conference, wonderful conference all weekend. Fantastic speakers, fantastic workshops, terrific topics, so many things to think about. And you know, and we walk in the door, and you know how you've been to one of those, and you know, serenity's just coming out of every orifice. Whoa, you know, we're just floating in, you know, and we're serene, and we're wonderful, and we're grateful, and it's just wonderful. And so we walk in the door Sunday, and I have just all this love and gratitude, and I have a treadmill in my garage. That's what I do for exercise. And so when I got home, I changed into my exercise clothes, and I go out to walk on my treadmill. And my son, my youngest son, who at that point was 20 years old, living at home with us and having lots of different problems of his own, but at any rate, and I was very concerned about this child and things that were happening in his life, and his weight bench is right next to my treadmill, and as I go to walk on my treadmill, I see on the weight bench a driver's license, and I pick up the driver's license, and it's a woman, and she's 32 years old and lives in Glendora, California, and I instantly, information from nowhere, lands here. She has been in my house, had sex with my 20-year-old son, has two kids, wants to marry him, and call me mom. I mean, I am there, like in 6 seconds. Instantaneously. Now, mind you, I've just been to a conference. I'm 15 years in Al-Anon. I go to meetings. I read the literature. I do everything we're supposed to do. And in 6 seconds, I will go to the dark side in a heartbeat when left alone. And so I walk in with the driver's license, and there's Butchie's laying on the couch, his favorite form of recreation. And I show him the driver's license, and he just looks at it. Yeah, you know, no imagination, nothing. This guy has nothing. You know, so I tell him what I think has happened over the weekend, you know. And he does, you know, his eyes roll back in his head, you know. It's just like, you are nuts, you are crazy, you go call Carol. Carol's my sponsor, you call Carol right now, and you tell her what you think's going on here. So I pick up the phone, I call Carol, tell Carol what I think has happened over the weekend. Carol, you know, rarely specifically tells me what to do. But when I got done telling her, she said, shut up. And she says, when that kid comes home and you talk to him, don't you dare say one word to him about the garbage that you thought up in that sick head of yours and dump that on that poor kid and make him feel bad about himself or what you think he's done just because you are living in fear right now. Don't you dare say one word to him. So, okay, fine, I listen to her. I'm not going to say anything. Well, as it turns out, my son works and goes to school and my job. I don't see him for 2 days by the time our schedules get lined up again. again. And by now, heck, 2 days, lots of information landed here. I forgot about that already. And he walks into the door, or he walks into the kitchen, rather, and he has the driver's license in his hand. And he says, "Mom, what do you do when you find a driver's license?" You know? So I don't tell him what I do when I find a driver's license. It's not a good example. See, this much at a time. I swear to God, it's just this much at a time. And that's just how it's been for me. This is why I keep coming back, because alone I will go to the dark side. I will think the worst every time. And the bottom line was that I was fearful for my child because he's having difficult times. So I read crap into everything. And then someone once told me, you know, if you're going to be thinking this bad stuff's going on, why don't you think good stuff for your child instead? Why don't you send good thoughts? It's just as easy to send good thoughts towards the person that you're fearful about as it is to send the scary ones. Someone told me fear also stands for forgetting everything is all right. You know, and most of the time standing here right now, everything is all right. But by myself, I'll think of the fearful thing. I can be on an airplane. I'm having a great time. I love to fly. But one little bump, ooh, we're crashing. We're going down. You know, I mean, I'm instantly at the funeral thinking all the people I sponsor there, what are they saying? They better say good stuff because I'm going to be really pissed if they don't. I mean, I'm like, you know, next thing I know, we're on the ground, didn't crash. Beautiful funeral, though. Should have been there, you know. I mean, absolutely. I just don't even understand. I pray every day. I do this stuff every day. And still, this icky stuff comes and lands in my head. And so I come to meetings. I share this stuff with you guys. You put me on the right path. Loving and kind, you know, all this stuff, unconditional love, these are not empty words. There's so much that stands behind our slogans. There's so much more meaning than just cutesy little things on the wall when you look at them. What does unconditional love mean to you? You know, what I've learned, what it means to me is that I love my husband, I love my children, I love them unconditionally. I don't always like what they do. The path that they have to go is scary for me sometimes, but I do love them unconditionally, and because of you, they know that. They know they can come to me, and I'll help them with whatever I can, and I keep my hands off from whatever I can't. I don't participate in the things that make me uncomfortable. You know, I get to have a relationship with them, and I get to love them, you know, and subsequently, you know, we don't have the best family on the block, but we all know that we love each other to the best of our ability. I have no doubt that my children are doing the best with their lives as I am trying to do the best with mine, as I know my husband is trying to do the best with his. You know, it's just about trying to get better one day at a time, and never, never underestimate the power of forgiveness. Because that's what lets you move on. That's just what lets you go on with your life. You know, and again, I'm amazed I had to come to a room full of strangers to learn how to love my own family. But that's just the way that it's been for me. You know, my favorite Christmas story is The Grinch. I just love it, you know. But to me, he's like just the typical Al-Anon of all time. You know, pacing up on the hill, pissed off at what the neighbors are doing down there. Doesn't like the way the neighbors are doing it. Wants to change it and make it be different. You know, what happens for The Grinch, you know, is that realization, that acceptance of people are exactly who they are, you know, and his heart grows big and his heart got full, you know, and that's what I say, Al-Anon just makes my heart big, and it feels good to have have your heart growing. It just is, it's an indescribable feeling, you know, and you know when you have those moments, you know when you're doing the right thing, you know exactly, and you know when you're not, because you know how uncomfortable it makes you feel, and those are the things that I learn here. I've got a friend in AA, Bob F., and he says people quit coming to AA and in Al-Anon because they quit being amazed. You know, and I think about that all the time. It's very important every day that I get to be amazed. And if I'm not amazed by my own stuff that's going on, then I get to be amazed by yours. I get to be amazed by the people I go to meetings with and watch them grow in this program. And as long as I keep being amazed, that intrigue to keep coming back. You know, so please, please, please keep going to your meetings. Please keep being amazed. Let your heart grow big. Feel good about yourself and who you are. Because that's, God really does want us to be happy, joyous, and free. Happiness is really an inside job. Again, all these words really do have so much meaning. Think about them and think how they apply to your life. And you'll just get better. You can't help it. You'll come to Al-Anon and life will just, you know, I'm not necessarily, but it's just going to help you. You know, and that's a good thing. That's really a wonderful thing. I've got a little teeny weeny little block thing in a little wood block, and it's got a little teeny weeny candle on it, and it all has a little caption on it, and it just says, "A candle loses nothing of its light by lighting another candle." The world just gets brighter. Thank you so much for lighting my candle.